This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott.
I felt my nerves a bit, and I don't feel that feeling a lot. The nerves of humility and modesty when being honored.
A surprisingly humble Kanye West there, speaking to the graduating class of the Art Institute of Chicago, where he was awarded an honorary doctorate earlier this month. It was clearly an emotional moment for the rapper, but what exactly is an honorary degree? Here to break down the purpose and process of honorary degrees is Dr. Robert O'Neill. He's former president at the University of Virginia, a former director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, and he's currently a fellow with the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges. Robert, welcome to the program. That's quite a mouthful, by the way.
It is, yes.
So does Kanye get to call himself Dr. West now?
He certainly is entitled to invoke that designation.
Well, being awarded a four-year degree or master's or a doctorate, really kind of a doorway to higher pay, maybe to previously inaccessible careers. So what is the function of an honorary degree? What does it do for the recipient?
It does a number of things. Sometimes it's simply a way of recognizing an outstanding member of the academic community or the business or professional community. Sometimes it reflects a focus on a geographical area. For example, Indiana University, from which I have an honorary degree, insists that there be some connection between the recipient and the state of Indiana as a fellow Hoosier.
Who is actually awarding the degree? Who's making the decision about who's being honored?
It's one of the very few tasks which can only be carried out by the governing board.
But what exactly are they looking for? I mean, there's such a wide variety of recipients. You know, is there a criteria that they're running through, a list of things that they're looking for?
In many cases, there is no such set of qualification or criteria, but in my view, there should be.
The cynic in me says that many honorary degrees are awarded particularly so the colleges might be able to line up great commencement speakers. Do you think that's ever the case?
No, I think that's not inappropriate, and I would be less inclined to be cynical at all in that regard. I think, in fact, if in the process a particular honoree is invited or expected to speak to the graduating class, then it seems to me that's not at all inappropriate, and I'd say that's a good reason for conferring an honorary degree.
Now, have there ever been any particularly controversial degrees that had the public or perhaps even students questioning the qualifications of a recipient?
There have been several recent controversies. For example, at Northwestern, there was much controversy over Jeremiah Wright, who was President Obama's initial pastor in the south side of Chicago. That honor was eventually withdrawn. Meanwhile, however, at Washington University in St. Louis, an expected conferral of an honorary degree in humane letters on Phyllis Schlafly became the source of intense controversy by a group of faculty, alumni, and students. But the governing board at WashU went ahead to confer the degree on Phyllis Schlafly, despite the controversy.
You know, what's interesting about this to me is that if you were to spend 4 years and earn your bachelor's and then do something that put you in the public light in a negative way, you know, nobody would say, well, we should rescind the degree that this person earned at this or that university. And so what's interesting about the honorary degree is that it really does seem to be a cultural designation.
Well, that's in substantial part, that's accurate. Although I should add that on rare occasions, a governing board has felt it necessary to revoke even a degree earned in due course. If there is, for example, a serious criminal violation.
You wrote in an article for the Association of Governing Boards of Colleges and Universities about Thomas Jefferson, who was actually the founder of the University of Virginia, where you were formerly president.
Yes.
And apparently he was against awarding degrees of any kind, or honorary or otherwise. And I wonder how you feel about that and whether you think that honorary degrees have a place today or whether or not there's a risk that they could dilute the sense of education that we get from formal schooling, from years of classes.
Even the great Thomas Jefferson was not totally consistent. He did refuse to confer any honorary degrees. To this day, the University of Virginia still does not confer honorary degrees. Interestingly, however, when invitations appeared from the other early colonial colleges, Mr. Jefferson seemed quite eager, and he seemed to have no difficulty in getting to Cambridge to receive an honorary degree from Harvard. I do expect that most institutions, with this relatively small number of exceptions, will continue to confer honorary degrees, but it has seemed to me that we could do a much better job of defining the criteria, describing the process that is to be followed, the consequences of conferral, and how to deal with contentious issues like those involving Phyllis Schlafly or Reverend Benjamin Wright.
Dr. Robert O'Neill, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Delighted to do so.
Dr. Robert O'Neill is former president at the University of Virginia. He's currently a senior fellow with the Association of Governing Boards of Colleges and Universities. It's graduating season, a time for celebration and, for some high school students, concern. And while the thought of donning a cap and gown may make some seniors tremble, there's a springtime event that can be even more anxiety-inducing, the prom. This story comes to us from Philip Baggett.
I've got this slight problem. Well, it's kind of big in my book. I can't find a prom date. I guess I'm really not good at it. I just kind of suck, I guess you could say. Yeah, that would be the best word for it. I suck. I know some of you guys are saying, not Phil, he could easily get a prom date. I mean, that shouldn't be a problem. What, you don't believe me? Here, listen to this. Kirsten, would you do me the honor of going to prom with me? How was that? What did you think about that?
It's not like he was asking to a ball. But
oh, see, you would. You see how you wouldn't have said yes?
I don't know if you should ask so politely nowadays.
Oh, that's kind of like 1943?
Problem. I won't even say that far back.
So you would have said no, wouldn't you? Yes.
Nah.
You're lying, aren't you?
No, I'm not lying.
Yeah, you probably are lying. But that's okay. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's okay.
No,
I'm perfectly fine with it. That's okay.
I'd, like, give them a reason why I really want to go with the specific person. Because, I mean, like, if you're just going around asking anybody, they're going to be like, oh, well, why me?
I mean, what you going to do? Get on your knees. You're not proposing. Just ask them.
So just ask.
Yeah.
Just ask. Isn't that a bunch? So what would be your strategy to asking someone to prom? How would you go about that?
Hey, you're coming to prom with me. That's it. No questions asked about it.
Clearly, that's not going to work. I'm going to have to find something else.
I think I would send, like, I would probably get, like, a little card, and I would decorate it. I would make my own card, and then I would put, like, a little yes or no box, and then, like, have one of my friends give it to them, and then I'd be right there watching. And then when they look at me, I would wink, and I'd be like, yeah, and then, like, mark X, and then they would have, like, a little colored pen.
Boy.
And then
I'm more lost than I thought I was. Why can't I ask a girl to prom? You know, it's strange because when I get in front of a girl, you know what the difficulty is? I start looking at me. I'll be like shaking or something. And then I'm like, this is like so embarrassing. And I'll start thinking about, oh my God, I didn't get my hair cut today, so I look a mess. So I mean, I'll give up, basically. You know what? It seems as if I'm just not gonna have a prom date. I can go to prom by myself and walk down that long, beautifully decorated hallway and see all the other people with their prom dates, and I'll just be there by myself with my tux.
With my tux.
Heather,
yeah,
would
yeah.
you do me the honor of going to prom with me?
Sure. Yes.
That story was produced by Philip Baggett for Curie Youth Radio in Chicago. And a little postscript, Philip did go to prom with Heather, and after graduation, he attended St. Xavier University. He's now an education advisor for Kaplan University. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We've heard the claim before. Low-income urban kids aren't getting to spend enough time in the woods, learning about the natural world in a hands-on environment. But what if outdoor education isn't just about where you live and what's around, but it's also the product of parenting, classroom-based school standards, and an increasingly limited freedom to explore? David Sobel is a senior faculty member at Antioch University, New England, and author of the book Beyond Ecophobia. He spoke with Virginia Prescott as part of NHPR's series, The First Decade, about gaps in children's outdoor education and what happens when kids are kept away from nature's classroom.
David, nice to speak with you again.
Nice to speak with you, Virginia.
It would be easy to believe kids growing up in New Hampshire, they must be immersed in rich outdoor environments and don't have this problem. Well, you don't think that's so. Why?
Yeah, it's not true in Manchester, and it's not true in Keene, and it's not true in Woodstock, New Hampshire either. This is broadly true for urban kids and rural kids, that they do not have access to the nearby natural world, and it's in great part a function of parental fears about things that are going to happen to their kids.
Rural kids, really?
Rural kids too. There's an interesting study that's been done in Wilmington, Vermont, and it was done 40 years ago, and the researcher redid some of it in the last few years, and there's been a radical change in kids' access to the natural world and to basically just being out in their neighborhoods over the course of the last 40 years. And Wilmington, Vermont has not changed much in 40 years, but the parental fears have changed a lot.
Well, let's talk about parents. How do you think kids being raised are being raised differently today in ways that might prevent them from taking advantage of the landscape?
Part of it's a problem of the fact that a lot of kids come from families that have two working parents, or a lot of kids come from families with just one parent. So a lot of time there's not a parent at home after school in order to supervise kids. So therefore, kids are sequestered in after-school programs or in sports programs or with child care providers who don't feel comfortable about kids being outside. And then there's just the lure of digital recreation. You know, kids spend up to 8 hours a day engaged with screens in some way, and, you know, some studies say 8 minutes a day outside or half an hour a day outside.
So what are the benefits of being outdoors, and what do you think is more important, time spent exploring in that kind of freewheeling way or a more guided educational experience for kids?
Yeah, it's not an either or. Both of those things are important. The free access exploratory experience in the outdoors is good for kids from the point of view of developing initiative and resilience and self-direction, as well as, you know, kind of learning about the natural world. The guided experience in terms of incorporating that into school programming and after-school programming is also really important in terms of developing a hands-on real-world basis for cognitive development.
You've written about Common Core standards getting in the way of environmental play from a very early age. How is that?
Yeah, it's not so much the Common Core standards getting in the way. It's high-risk testing initiatives that have gotten in the way. In other words, the whole pressure to perform well on tests makes schools and teachers feel like they've got to do the drill and kill things in school.
There are, however, an increasing number of quote-unquote nature schools that are aimed at preschoolers and kindergartners. So how are they different than the typical educational programs?
Yeah, these places are really different, or they range from kind of different to really different. There's a bunch of nature preschools. There's half a dozen of them probably in New Hampshire, where the kids are outside, you know, up to half of the day, as opposed to most conventional preschools where kids are outside maybe 15% of the day. And then there are what are being called forest kindergartens, where the kids are outdoors, you know, could be 75% to 100% of the day. And some of those don't have any indoor facilities at all. So this is kids really being outside a lot. And it creates that kind of foundational sense of connectedness with the natural world that leads to later adult values and behaviors. But it also develops this, you know, grittiness and resilience on the part of kids that a lot of people think is the foundation for school success.
Well, those don't sound like public programs. How much does something like that cost?
There are some of them are public programs, but these programs are equivalent to what most, you know, preschool or early childhood programs cost, and in some cases they're less expensive, especially the ones that don't have much in terms of indoor facilities, because that's a reduced cost. So it's not that expensive. And some programs, we're just doing some research on a nature preschool in Michigan where, you know, the kids that are in the nature preschool are publicly funded, so they're attending for free.
David, any hard data on how early experiences being outdoors actually affects kids?
Yeah, it's we're doing some of that right now, but there is some hard data from European studies, especially Scandinavian studies of nature preschools, what they call actually school in all weather or forest kindergartens. And in comparative studies of kids in nature kindergartens versus more conventional kindergartens or more conventional preschools, they found that kids got sick less frequently, that their attendance was higher, and that their physical development was more substantial if you were in these forest kindergarten programs. There's also some interesting research on language development, that the outdoors nature experience is better in terms of language development for kids.
Well, I think oftentimes we think of people who are outdoorsy or recreational. You know, I think of when I was growing up, the families who went skiing on vacation or went camping on vacation, those people had money. Is there anything to that, that there's a kind of gap between the rich and poor in terms of outdoor and indoor education?
Yeah, I think certainly kids with middle or upper income families have way more access to lots of recreational opportunities. And as a function of inner city kids living in places where it's harder to access the outdoors and transportation costs more, that certainly is a disadvantage for them. So, yeah, but a lot of people are commenting on the fact that even upper income kids wind up being much more interiorized than, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Mm.
Well, let's talk about one of the places where kids get to spend a lot of quality time outside. That's at summer camp, which, as many parents know, can be very expensive. Does the price of summer camp leave some kids behind?
Yeah, completely. And that's why Fresh Air Fund and all those kinds of programs are great. I have hypothesized, though I don't know that anybody's actually done this research, that if you were going to do one thing for urban kids that was going to have an impact on their lives and their relationship with the natural world, funding summer camp would be the thing you would do.
What kinds of parenting choices can be made to make a difference here and get kids outside more often?
The National Wildlife Federation has a Green Hour initiative that encourages parents to have kids outside at least an hour a day. And so, you know, parental intentions to have, you know, go on walks, go on bike rides, be outside exploring with your kids for some chunk of the day is a really important thing. Family nature clubs are a great initiative of the Children and Nature Network, where they encourage families with young children just to create informal groups that go on outings together. And they don't have kind of curricular objectives. It's just, you know, we're going to go to the park and we're going to spend the morning with our kids outside doing things in the meadows and the streams. So those are good things. And then, feeling a little bit looser about kids being outside on their own, you know, with mild supervision rather than rigid supervision is something that parents can do too.
David Sobel there, speaking with Virginia Prescott. Sobel is a senior faculty member at Antioch University, New England, and author of the book Wild Play, Parenting Adventures in the Great Outdoors. You can see all the stories from our special series, The First Decade, at nhpr.org. While you're there, take a look at our infographics on the declining population of kids in the state, the income gap between single mothers and families headed by married couples, and House by House. That's a digital story that shows some of the disparities in the lives of New Hampshire families on either end of the income spectrum. All those stories and more on our series page for The First Decade. You can find a link at nhpr.org. Colony collapse disorder, the sudden disappearance of honeybee colonies, is often posed as something of a biological mystery, an ominous whodunit of the natural world. That's not quite true. Scientists have been able to identify a few probable causes, among them loss of habitat, the spread of a parasitic mite, and pesticide-treated crops, though that last one has not gone unchallenged. Well, two new studies out this spring have provided increasing evidence that a commonly used type of pesticide is harmful to bees of all kinds. And joining us to tell us more is Dave Goulson, a bee researcher at the University of Sussex in England and the author of the new book, A Buzz in the Meadow, The Natural History of a French Farm. And Dave, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much.
So let me start off by saying that colony collapse disorder is really just part of the overall problem, and it's the one we maybe hear about the most. But what about that term do you find misleading, and how would you maybe reframe the plight of the world's bees today?
Well, so colony collapse disorder is specifically about honeybees, and I should say that there are lots of species of bee. I actually work on bumblebees, which are one of the sort of groups of wild bees. And people do get rather hung up on talking about honeybees as if they're the only bee that matters. Or indeed, I think some people think they might be the only bee that exists. but actually, there are thousands of so 4,000 species of bee in the United States alone. And they're all important. So to come back to colony collapse disorder, it's a term that's bandied around a lot. It was originally intended to describe a particular kind of symptom of honeybee colonies dying, where the bees kind of disappeared, and it was a bit mysterious. It had other names. Marie Celeste syndrome was one of them.
Yeah, a little less sexy, that one.
Yeah, but probably more appropriate. But these days, it's used to describe more or less any kind of colony dying at any time of year for any reason. So it gets a bit confusing as to what people really mean. And it would be simpler if we just talked about colonies dying, I think.
So two new studies looking at how pesticides, and specifically a variety called, I'm not sure if I'm going to get this right, neonicotinoids?
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So these neonicotinoids are affecting bees. What do these two studies reveal?
There's really a lot of scientific evidence that these pesticides harm bees. The new studies, two very different studies that appeared alongside each other in the journal Nature last month, and one of them is kind of interesting and intriguing. They set out to find out whether bees could detect these pesticides when they turn up in pollen and nectar of flowers. And what they found was that they can't detect them. But the really weird thing is that they found that although the bees couldn't detect them, they fed on them more when given a choice between, you know, sugar water that was healthy and sugar water with added toxins, which is a really odd thing for the bees to do, obviously, and rather unfortunate. This was in a lab situation, and if that happened in the real world, it might mean that bees are being exposed to more than we'd realize.
So they can't taste them or whatever, yeah, whatever the analogy is. But maybe why do they prefer them then?
Well, we're not quite sure. They do try to explain it. They suggest that there's a kind of addictive effect, that although they can't tell they're there, that they somehow feel the urge to go back and have more. I'm not sure I fully get that, and I'm not sure it's entirely convincing. But nonetheless, you know, it's a really interesting result. The other paper is much more important. It describes a big field trial. And they didn't just look at honeybees. They looked at honeybees and bumblebees and a species of little solitary bee called Osmia. They basically put colonies of each of these things next to fields of canola, either treated with one of these neonicotinoids or control healthy fields. And they basically found very big effects on the bumblebees and on the solitary bees, and negligible effects on the honeybees, confirming something we'd already begun to suspect, which is that wild bees may be much more sensitive to these things than honeybees are.
And when you say effects, you're talking about health effects, not just that they preferred one field over the other, but that it impacted their population.
Yeah. So bumblebee colonies grew really slowly, produced hardly any new queens. The solitary bees didn't breed at all anywhere near these treated fields. So really dramatic kind of population level effects on these bees.
So now this goes against some of the claims made by pesticide manufacturers and other folks who've been critical of studies linking pesticides and bee health, because often they were saying that, well, these are lab studies, you know, this isn't the way it is in the wild.
Yeah, well, this one is definitely a field study. They can't lay that one on this particular piece of research. And actually, I would disagree with them anyway. I think long before this particular piece of research was published, it was pretty clear that these chemicals are contributing to the problems bees have in the real world. The point we're at right now is where about 90% of the research agrees that these things harm bees and 10% disagrees. But almost all that 10% is research conducted by the people who manufacture the chemicals themselves. And one has to question whether that's truly impartial.
I'm speaking with bee researcher Dave Golson. He's author of A Buzz in the Meadow, about two new studies linking a specific type of ubiquitous pesticide to alarming declines in bee health. Now, the European Union has temporarily banned three types of these pesticides, and with these new studies, I'm guessing that ban will likely hold. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency has said that it will be unlikely to approve new neonicotinoid pesticides in light of these studies. Now, I'm wondering, do you see these policies as half measures or a step in the right direction? You know, we're banning some of them, but not all of them, or saying no more new ones, but we can still use the ones we have. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, steps in the right direction, certainly, but slightly unsatisfactory in many ways. I mean, certainly the US position is basically allows business as usual. The EU situation is slightly different in that we now have this moratorium on the three most commonly used of these chemicals, and they can't be used on flowering crops, basically. They're still being used on other crops, but not on ones that flower and bees might feed on. The problem we have in the EU is that a lot of countries have granted individual derogations to farmers to use them anyway. So the ban is not 100% watertight, and it's hard to see that it's being terribly effective if many of these chemicals are actually continuing to be used.
Now, I want to talk about a few things that I learned in your new book about some of the other factors contributing to the decline in bee populations, because you point out that there are many of them. And in North America, anyway, some of the decline might have to do with bees having a really poor diet. How so?
So it's everyone's got very hung up on pesticides, and you know, they probably are part of the problem, but it's good not to lose sight of other things, right. Other problems that bees face, and one of them is certainly food, and that may well actually be the biggest of them all. There are very few flowers in farmland these days. You know, bees used to thrive in natural meadows and woodland and so on, where there were lots of flowers and a big diversity of flowers for them to feed on. It's essentially, yeah, the modern world just doesn't have much food for them. But it also has offers them a very limited diet in terms of the kind of diversity of flowers. So most honeybee hives in North America live a rather bizarre life where they're shipped around thousands of miles every year. So they're famously taken to California to pollinate the almonds in March. Mm-hmm. And then after the almonds, they might be taken over to the East Coast to pollinate the blueberries. So for a month, they feed on nothing but almond pollen. And then the next month, they're feeding on nothing but blueberry pollen and so on. So you imagine you had nothing to eat for a month but chocolate, and then the next month you had nothing to eat but sardines, say, and you'd probably not be feeling too good.
Both emotionally and physically, I would think.
Absolutely. So you can imagine these poor bees, you know, their life isn't ideal, and we probably shouldn't be surprised if this is contributing to their occasionally dying, or more than occasionally dying, as it seems these days.
Well, do you think it's easier to fight pesticide use than it is maybe to change those deeper notions about how we farm and how we cultivate food? Maybe it's just easier to focus on a chemical.
Yes, it is. But it obviously does raise the bigger issue of, you know, the future of, well, it might sound overly dramatic, but the future of the planet, if you like. You know, I think there are broad issues about the sustainability of the kind of modern paradigm of food production. You know, we've gone down this route of very intensive farming with lots of pesticides, vast monocultures of crops. And you could argue that with a growing human population, that's the only way we can feed everybody. But I think we should kind of question that, because there are concerns that, you know, if we're making the modern world inhospitable for bees, and they decline to a point where we're not getting our crops pollinated, then actually, you know, this drive to increase food production through intensive farming could actually be counterproductive. We can't really carry on doing these things long term, in my view, and we need to think more kind of holistically and think what our grandchildren are going to have to pollinate their crops, and what they're going to have to grow their crops in, and so on. The way we're going at the moment, we could well be leaving them with a pretty poor heritage.
Well, actually, that makes me think that, you know, your new book really illustrates what I see as probably a two-pronged approach to conservation. You know, part of it is about inspiring us to be amazed at the wonders of the natural world, and you talk about the intricate lives and biology of it's amazing insects. And that's something we haven't talked about too much in this interview. It also points to this very bleak future that we often hear about when it comes to environmental coverage. Which of these strategies do you think is more important to changing minds, especially young minds?
It is a difficult one. As a conservationist, I find myself sort of treading this knife edge a lot of the time. You know, if you're too doom and gloom, I think you lose people. They switch off and they go right. And turn on the PlayStation or something. I don't know what they do. it's good to, you know, to try and be positive wherever you can and say, well, actually, you know, it's not too late. We can turn this around. And one of the nice things about bees is that they're something that people can get involved in conserving. A lot of conservation stories, you know, the rainforests, tigers, polar bears, pandas, mm-hmm. and so on. It's really hard to help any of those things as an individual. You know, what can you do about the poor polar bears, the ice caps melting and so on. And so people kind of switch off and give up. But with bees, they can help. Everyone has access to a little bit of garden or a park or somewhere where they can plant a few flowers, or in a schoolyard where they could plant some flowers. And it really does make a difference. You know, if every gardener in North America and Europe planted a few bee-friendly flowers in their garden, then there'd be an awful lot more food for bees and for hoverflies and butterflies and so on. And it really would make a difference.
Well, Dave, I'm really glad we got to end on a positive note.
Excellent.
Dave Golson is a bee researcher at the University of Sussex, and his new book is A Buzz in the Meadow, The Natural History of a French Farm. You can read more about his work and those two new studies on neonicotinoids and bee health at wordofmouthradio.org. Officially, there are no cougars in Maine. But you wouldn't get that impression talking to the many people who've claimed to see them roaming through the wilderness. Before he was NHPR's health reporter, Jack Rodolico filed this story on Maine's mysterious cougars for the Salt Institute.
Roddy Glover and Rosemary Townsend live 100 miles from each other in Maine. They've never met. Roddy's hunted everything with four legs. Rosemary says she doesn't know much about wildlife. But both claim they had a chance encounter with nature's perfect predator.
And I was just contemplating what a beautiful sight the pond was because it looked like little diamonds dancing with the sun sparkling on it.
And I'm looking up the tracks, and I can see something moving. And as it got closer, I could see this too.
And an animal walked out on the far side.
At first, I thought they were like dogs.
But he did have a certain slink to him, which I thought was a little odd for a dog.
Then as it got closer, I said, those ain't dogs. Those ain't even walking like dogs.
Stocky legs, a tawny color.
Those are big, big cats.
He made eye contact because he was only about 50 yards from me.
But I just got my heart pumping, that's all. You know, you're just seeing what I'm seeing.
Rosemary and Roddy's sightings are on file with Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife.
Oh, let's see this one. This might be the one that we're talking about.
Wally Jacobus, the department's lead mammal biologist, showed me some cougar photos people had emailed him over the years.
Oh, big cat by barn. I know which this is. I think this is another house cat one.
Yep, there it is.
There it is. Okay, so what is it? Is it a cougar or is it a kitty?
Of the 80 photos in Wally's inbox, none shows a cougar in Maine. Instead, there are deer, coyotes, bobcats, dogs, and, yes, plenty of kitties. This happens all the time. There's an idea that cougars are so elusive, hard evidence of their presence is tricky to come by. But where cougars live out west and down in Florida, there are tracks, photos, dead deer, and cougar roadkill. They get hit by cars all the time. None of this is reported in Maine.
Oh, cougars have their own place on the mantle for crazy stories, right? It's hard to top them.
This doesn't happen with bears, or coyotes, or squirrels and chipmunks. Just cougars. So if the cougar's been gone for 100 years, why is it living on in our imaginations? Two 200 years ago, nothing in Maine was more feared than the catamount, or cougar, the only animal known to stalk humans. That earned catamounts some intimidating nicknames: Indian Devil, Screamer, Ghost Cat. Historical records from the 1800s read like ghost stories.
Some, likewise, being lost in the woods, have heard such terrible roarings as have made them much aghast, which must either be devils or lions.
They were suddenly aroused by a piercing shriek a short distance away. As the dreaded sound came nearer and nearer, the camp was thrown into a panic.
I heard his shrill screech, like that of a woman in distress. I heard the same screech and saw the same track again not far off. I think the animal was a catamount.
Soon after, there were sounds of conflict, and hurrying to the scene found his dog in the throes of death, almost torn to shreds. The residents are in a terrified condition and dare not venture out after nightfall.
This ferocious beast.
Blood-curdling yells.
A large panther.
Then the record gets quiet. By 1900, forests were chopped down for farms and deer were nearly eradicated. With no habitat or food, catamounts had few places to hide. And because large predators were seen as a threat, they were exterminated throughout the country. But a few catamounts hung on in the Northeast. What's widely considered to be the last eastern cougar was seen on the Maine-Quebec border in 1938. It was shot. The science says there's no evidence of a cougar population in Maine. But there are two glitches in the data. Roddy Glover and Rosemary Townsend, the people you heard from earlier, they actually saw cougars. It was confirmed by tracks and DNA evidence. So if there are no eastern cougars, why are there still cougars in the east? I decided to go talk to Ann about this.
Morning, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Good.
We walked by her house with her five huge dogs.
Look at that guy, wow. So what kind of dog is he?
He's an English Mastiff.
Walked through the containment gate in her backyard. And that's where I met her cougar. And then I met her other cougar. Anne asked me not to use her last name because she knows of exotic pet owners who've been harassed. She lives out on a rural highway. You'd have no idea there are two 120-pound cats in her backyard.
You know, we want to be what's called responsible owners. And
Anne's one of a small handful of residents in Maine who legally own a pet cougar. No one knows how many illegally kept cougars are in Maine or anywhere else. One estimate says 1,000 east of the Mississippi.
I think the illegal people who own these cats probably have a dog kennel. I'm going to say within a year they've probably figured out their way in over their heads.
And what starts to happen in that year that really makes you start to realize?
Well, their power, their strength, their size, their ability to jump, the amount of food they eat.
The expense?
The expense is huge, enormous, you know.
Once they're in over their heads, no one really knows what illegal owners do with their cats. Some are probably sold, some are euthanized. But there have been documented cases of escape or release.
She's beautiful.
The illegal cougar trade leads to legit sightings and perpetuates the myth that cougars are out there, says Mark McCullough. Mark was doing research for a paper about cougars, and he decided to poke around online for cougars for sale.
Did you get a lot of middle-aged women looking for younger men?
Yeah. I didn't even know what a blue-haired cougar was until I got into this. This is amazing.
Mark's an endangered species specialist with the Federal Department of Fish and Wildlife. This spring, his paper declared the eastern cougar extinct. He believes we might share a collective cultural guilt for persecuting large, mysterious animals, and that contributes to why we see them.
There's no doubt that there is something more to the phenomenon of the eastern cougar and why it persists in our psyche, even though it's been gone for 100 years or more. So, and I think what that is, when you really drill down, is hope. We all hope. It's just part of what we are as a species. Hope is part of who we all are.
I think Mark is onto something there.
Keel Kemper's a regional biologist for the state. He's gone out on lots of cougar calls.
But we're so getting into arena that most biologists are fairly uncomfortable being in. But there are those among us who are much more free-spirited and are much more willing to seek out their animal totem, if you will, and go and commune with them.
If there's no physical evidence on the scene, Keel says it's useless to tell somebody that they didn't see what they think they saw. They saw it, he says, not him. Keel also points out all large animals have a passionate fan club. But he says there's a difference with cougars. In true cougar country, the cats are often seen as a hazard, whereas in Maine,
where they still remain as a gossamer, ghost-like experience, it's very easy to be enthralled with that passion. But if one's standing outside the door, I don't think you're going out the door and give him a big hug. You know, I think you're like going to realize that, you know, this critter can kill me and eat me.
Keel's still faced with a dilemma, though. Most calls come from articulate, sober adults. He says escape pets are the most logical conclusion to legit sightings, but
if it shows up in your yard and your children are out there playing, you really don't care what the origin of it was. That is the most logical explanation. But that then just starts the question, now what?
In every state between Maine and the Mississippi River, people swear they saw a ghost cat. And some of them are right. But here's an anecdote. In 1978, in the Netherlands, a red panda escaped from a zoo. Word got out through the news, and soon 100 people called in sightings from all over Holland. The little red panda was found soon enough. It had been hit by a train a few hundred yards from the zoo. The cougar reinforces a universal truth. There is no more imperfect match than proof and belief. For Salt Radio, I'm Jack Rodolico. Jack Rodolico produced that piece for the Salt Institute in 2011, a few years before becoming NHPR's health reporter. A quick Google search can tell you that since then, there have been plenty more heavily disputed cougar sightings in Maine and in New Hampshire, too. Earlier in the program, we spoke with bee researcher Dave Goulson about the link between pesticides and bees and about bee health in general. After that interview, he told us about one way that anybody can help our friendly pollinators out: build a bee hotel.
In my garden home, I
stuck a fence post in the ground and drilled a load of holes in it just with an electric drill. And within 20 minutes, I had the first bee come and take up residence in one of these holes and start filling it with pollen. I don't guarantee it'll work, but on the whole, they usually end up with these bees, and you can watch them coming and going, and it's great fun.
Dave Goulson there, author of A Buzz in the Meadow, The Natural History of a French Farm. You can check out some pictures of bee hotels and some adorable little bee tenants at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for listening today. If you missed anything, you can always catch the show in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes and click subscribe. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend or make a rating. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.